It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello again, everybody. My next guest is an amazing human rights activist who we are told has been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. In fact, that's a matter of public record. We just confirmed it. She, her family, really, has been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. In fact, she could be part of the first family to win the Nobel Peace Prize as a family if her supporters get their way. Mariam Al-Khawaja and her kin are trying to democratize the Persian Gulf nation of Bahrain through peaceful resistance, not a rebel army, as is taking place, of course, in nearby Syria. Hers is one of the lesser-known Arab Spring movements known as the Pearl Revolution, but Bahrain has an entrenched royal family and also houses the U.S. Fifth Fleet. Bahrain, by the way, has such an interesting geopolitical history. It's a collection of more than 30 islands in the Persian Gulf, mostly Shiite by religion. They found oil in the 1930s, fought on the side of the Allies in World War II, then fought against both British and Iranian dominance, finally becoming fully independent in the 1970s. The ruling Al-Khalifa royal family goes back centuries. Though Bahrain opposed the Iraq War, President Bush declared them a major non-NATO ally during that period. The U.S. Fifth Naval Fleet, as I mentioned, is stationed there. There was an Arab Spring uprising in 2011, same time as the others, but that mostly failed. So let's learn more about Bahrain and this resolutely nonviolent activist family that seems to be right from the Mandela, Gandhi, Martin Luther King mold, and we'll tell you about an event taking place in New York tomorrow. Mariam Al-Khawaja, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
And first, for listeners unfamiliar with Bahrain, what would you correct about my geopolitical cheat sheet? I'm sure I compressed it down so much, it must be wrong or misleading in some way.
I think you got most of it right. One interesting fact that I think a lot of people don't know is that the ruling family in Bahrain actually took over the island approximately 230 years ago. And have been ruling it since then. The Bahrain was a British protectorate, and so the British left. It wasn't really the ruling family that forced them to leave, but rather them leaving the region in the 1970s.
And in the 50s, Iran declared Bahrain part of Iran?
Well, Iran has been, you know, Iran and Saudi Arabia have been playing this tug of war politically in the region for some time now. And yes, Bahrain has been one of the countries that's been in the middle of that. And Iran has been, in several statements, stated things like this. But of course, the Bahrainis themselves, there was a consensus inside Bahrain done where the Bahrainis themselves said that this is not true and Bahrain is not a part of Iran.
And there was actually a referendum in the 1970s that led to its current independent status, correct?
Exactly. And in the 1970s, of course, there was also a constitution of 1973, which gave people a real parliament, but of course was dissolved 2 years later. And the current constitution that we have in Bahrain, which is the constitution of 2002, was unilaterally put in by the king, and he made himself king. So he's a self-acclaimed king, actually.
So how much democracy is there in Bahrain today?
I would say, first of all, it depends on your definition of democracy, of course. But what we're looking at in Bahrain is that we have an absolute monarchy. The king is the head of the government. He's the head of the entire system. And, of course, he appoints the prime minister, who's the head of government. The prime minister is the king's uncle, who's been in power for more than 40 years now. He's the longest lasting prime minister in the history that we know of. And so we're looking at a situation where people do not have basic liberties and freedoms and rights that they should have as human beings.
What does your movement want? What specifically are you focusing on?
Well, for people on Bahrain, there's two different groups currently on the ground. There's the political societies who are demanding a constitutional monarchy and reforms, while there's the February 14th coalition, which has the majority support of the people in opposition, and they're demanding the stepping down of the monarchy. They're demanding the right to self-determination. For us, as human rights activists, of course, our demands are not political, but rather more focused on a human rights perspective.
Do you use the term Pearl Revolution to refer to the democracy movement?
Not really. Usually people call it the February 14th Revolution because that's the day it started on. But also, you know, the Pearl the Pearl Square actually was something very important to the Bahraini Revolution, because that's where the majority or the biggest protests took place. It was basically the Tahrir Square of Bahrain. And the monument, the Pearl Monument, became the symbol of the Bahraini Revolution after the regime in Bahrain decided to tear it down after they cracked down on the protests.
Now, you were brought to my attention by Lawrence Weschler from the NYU Institute for the Humanities, who will be hosting this event tomorrow night that you'll be appearing at. And listeners, if you're already interested in Maryam al-Khawaja's story and want to go to this, it's at 6:30 at NYU's Vanderbilt Hall, 40 Washington Square South, tomorrow, free and open to the public. Details at nyihumanities.org and on our website. But Lawrence Weschler from the Institute for the Humanities brought you to my attention and has been one of those people arguing that your family should win the Nobel Peace Prize for your efforts. Can you tell us about your father and what his role has been in Bahrain?
Yes, of course. My father has been a human rights defender for as long as I can remember. He left Bahrain when he was a very young boy, around in his teenage years, to study abroad, but then he got involved in the rights movement at the time, because Bahrain, since the 1920s, there's been an uprising almost every 10 years. It's one of the oldest civil rights movements in the region. And so he was very involved in the movement that happened back then. And he stayed involved within the human rights community. So he set up the Bahrain Human Rights Organization in Copenhagen when we were living there. And then after we went back to Bahrain in 2001, he set up the Bahrain Center for Human Rights. And what he did was not only work on documenting human rights violations, but he very much believed in spreading awareness and education of what human rights are and what civil disobedience means. And this was long before he really had much support in doing what he did. And of course, what he became very well known for was his 110-day hunger strike, which ended with the regime force-feeding him. And this was an attempt to bring light to the plight of the political prisoners in Bahrain and the human rights violations that were ongoing.
So is he under arrest today?
He was sentenced to life imprisonment in 2011. Of course, most of the charges brought against him, although the main charges are things like terrorism and attempting to violently overthrow the regime. But the actual charges, if you look at the case, are based on freedom of expression rather than any actual criminal charges.
So your father has a life sentence for what you say is expressing himself and organizing nonviolent civil disobedience.
Yes.
What kind of nonviolent civil disobedience?
Well, there are many different forms. So it's either, you know, whether it's educational, where you hold public seminars and you speak about human rights and what that means, or giving speeches. He gave several speeches at the Pearl Square. But then he also participated in the peaceful protests that were happening. So there are the many different tools and ways of using nonviolent means, you know, to try and bring attention or to put pressure on a regime to reform or to change.
Listeners, if you have any questions for our guest, Maryam al-Khawaja, you can give us a call at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Her formal title is Acting Director of the Bahrain Center for Human Rights, and she's part of this Nobel-nominated al-Khawaja family. 212-433-9692, if you'd like to ask her anything or say anything about the situation there and its international implications, which we'll get into. But I want to get to the at least a third member of your family. Your sister is also involved in this human rights movement.
Yes. Well, of course, there's also my uncle, who's currently in prison with my father in the same case. And then there's my sister, who's had up to 13 or 14 different cases brought against her at court for doing things like staging one-person protests, or for, you know, speaking out against what was happening. Currently, she's serving a 3-month and 22 days sentence. She should be released at the end of June, but she has two more cases coming up during this month, and so her prison sentence might be extended. But for us, the biggest worry right now, or the biggest concern right now, is that they're being denied family visits, as well as consular visits and lawyer visits, and they're also denied access to sanitary items like shampoos or soaps and so on.
And you yourself are a Danish citizen and work primarily from outside the country, is that correct?
Yes.
Do you spend time in the country now? Do you see your family?
Since the beginning, or since I left Bahrain, which was in March 2011, I was lucky to leave Bahrain right before the Gulf Cooperation Council troops came into the country. And so since then, I've only been back once, which was last January. And I think I was planning to go again in the summer, but the way it looks like right now, it seems like it's not a good idea because the situation is really escalating, especially in targeting human rights defenders.
Do you want anything from the United States to help bring democracy or at least enhanced human rights to your country?
I think, you know, the question is more not what we want, but what the United States' responsibility towards the situation in Bahrain is. The United States is one of the closest allies, if not the closest ally, to the Bahraini government, and they supply them with arms, and they also have economic deals with the government there. And the fact that business as usual is happening right now, despite the ongoing widespread human rights violations, is very problematic. The United States does have a responsibility towards human rights. You know, nobody in Bahrain is asking for boots on the ground or a military intervention from the United States or from NATO. What they want is for countries like the United States and the United Kingdom to do their responsibility towards human rights and to put pressure on the Bahraini government to stop the human rights violations.
Would a public word from President Obama be meaningful, or is it more about what he and his diplomats do in private?
I think, you know, a year ago, statements made a huge difference. So when, you know, the United States would make a statement, for example, about the medics, they were released. But today, because the Bahraini regime now believes that they have international impunity and that even if there is a statement, it will never actually, you know, be translated into actual consequences towards the Bahraini government, they don't feel like there is any incentive for them to actually stop the human rights violations. That's why we continue to see the human rights situation deteriorate.
Let's take a phone call. Sally in Greenwich, you're on WNYC with our guest Mariam Al-Khawaja. Hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. You know, we've heard there's a lot of Arab revolutions that we've seen, and our hope, of course, in the United States is that they're for freedom and, you know, more democracy. We've also seen them, you know, become growingly more religious in nature. So I'm wondering how does she see this the Shia versus Sunni versus secular democratization of Bahrain?
Well, thank you for your question. I think, you know, it's a very important question because it also relates to what the situation is and how it's developing. But the Bahraini uprising, of course, started with people asking for reforms, not even the stepping down of the government or the monarchy. But then it, of course, developed into people demanding the stepping down because of the ongoing shootings, killings, and torture and arrests that were happening. What I've been saying to the U.S. administration as well as other governments that I've been meeting with is that the Bahraini movement was not about religion. It was not about sect. The crackdown that the Bahraini regime implemented against the Bahraini people was very sectarian in nature. And they did this because they knew that if they could create a sectarian strife inside the country, this would be better for them and for their for them staying in power. And so what they tried to do is they tried to create a sectarian split in the, you know, the main idea of divide and conquer. And so they've been implementing this in a very, very bad way. And they have, to some extent, succeeded in creating a split between the Sunnis and the Shias in the country. And so, yes, it is turning into a situation where I worry and I fear that it might come to a point where we will see sectarian strife inside the country. But I think we still have a window of opportunity where if we can get the right kind of pressure inside Bahrain and stop the systematic implementation of, you know, separating between the two sects inside the country and creating sectarian strife by the monarchy, then we might be able to avoid that.
How much of the democracy movement is an Islamist movement?
The democracy movement in Bahrain, albeit the Bahraini community or society is religious in nature, but it wasn't about religion. When people came out, they were demanding things like a civil government, institutionalizing human rights. They were talking about women's rights and, you know, children's rights and all kinds of different rights and having a constitution that represented the people as well as the government. So this was the main idea or the main demands of the movement in Bahrain.
I don't know how religiously oriented you are, what you would want in those respects, but are you somewhat dismayed personally, as a nonviolent, civil disobedience advocate who's looking for human rights, that Islamists are rising in some of the Arab Spring countries after the dictators have fallen?
I think that, you know, it's not the best outcome of the situation, especially given the human rights abuses that are ongoing in many of these countries. But it's also part of the process. People, you know, when you deny people the right to be a part of the political process, you're giving them more legitimacy, or you give them more support. And I think it's very important to make sure that people are allowed to be part of the political process so that the community or the society and the population get to know what it is that they want for themselves and what they don't want. And once they get to try these different types of governments or the different types of rule, then they can decide for themselves if this is something that they think is good for them or not. But what for us is a concern, of course, is the very basics of human rights and liberties. Those are things that are not to be bargained with, and those are things that should be, you know, it should be a given. It's something that should be guaranteed for all people.
And one other thing on the religious political aspects, Ren Wessler from NYU Institute for the Humanities argues that a Nobel Peace Prize for a mostly Shiite human rights movement in Bahrain could help support the human rights movement in Iran. Do you think that's right?
I think that's, you know, it's problematic in itself to refer to different movements through sects, because then we're actually creating a self-fulfilling prophecy of where we're talking about it being a sectarian movement, and because we continue to repeat that, it actually turns into that at the end of the day. I think that giving different kinds of prizes to different people who are advocating the right thing, like nonviolence, like human rights and liberties, it does give more of a platform for other people as well. And once, you know, you're helping people succeed in one country, you're actually helping them succeed in another.
Tedla in Flushing, you're on WNYC with Bahraini human rights activist Mariam Al-Khawaja. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, Brian. I'm one of the supporters of the Bahraini movement because I was very much impressed, especially by the youth. But I want to ask Mariam a very simple question. You are now fighting not only the Bahrain monarchy, you are fighting also the Saudi monarchy. I'm pretty sure that the security people who are harassing and intimidating the Bahraini human rights activists are the same as the people, the hands of Saudi Arabia. So for you, you are now in a delicate situation. United States is supporting the Saudi government and the Bahrain government. Have you tried the South African model of boycotting everything of this tyrannical monarchy by organizing a boycott campaign so that the university students in the United States all over the world will support you in boycotting anything that has to do with the tyrannical regime of Bahrain?
Well, thank you for the question. I think, you know, the point that you bring up is very important, which is the issue of boycott. At the time being, it's a bit difficult to organize such a huge campaign because of the geopolitical situation in the region. And yes, you're right. You know, when the Bahraini people started the uprising, they knew that they weren't fighting one government, but rather six governments with the support of some Western powers. So it is a very difficult situation, and they know that they're in it for the long haul. But I think, you know, the idea of boycotting the Bahraini government, but also the governments that support it, is something, or a tool that can be used, but also bringing awareness to the situation itself. Unfortunately, Bahrain is one of the countries where you rarely ever hear about what's going on the ground and what's happening. And I think just bringing awareness to the situation does make a difference.
As Gandhi and Dr. King and others taught us, nonviolent resistance doesn't just mean being passive. And there are a few who engage in violence against the regime in Bahrain. And I read that your father, close to death at one point on his hunger strike, urged democracy and human rights supporters to remain peaceful if he died and never harm anyone in his name. Do you have to fight on two fronts, against the government and against protesters who would resort to violence to bring about change?
You know, I think it's two different issues when you look at it from that perspective. First of all, I think with the issue of violence or the use of things like Molotov cocktails and stones by protesters, we have to see it from a context if we want to resolve the situation. And of course, you can never equal systematic state-run violence with the use of a couple of youth violent methods to try and put pressure on the government. For us as human rights defenders, of course, time and time again, we've said that we do not support the use of violence. And it is becoming a bit of a challenge for us to continue to convince people that violence is not the way to go. And a lot of this is because of the international situation towards Bahrain. When you're looking at a situation where Bahraini people feel like they've been completely isolated internationally, that there's no pressure, no accountability for the Bahraini government abroad, they feel like the tools that they can use or the the different ways that they can actually put pressure on the government are becoming more limited. When you have a civil rights movement, a nonviolent movement, you do need that kind of support to be able to create change, especially when you're not just fighting against one government, but a government that heavily relies, its existence heavily relies on other governments as well. And so it's for us as human rights defenders, I feel like to a certain extent we are losing our footing, because now when I talk to people about civil rights movements or civil disobedience and nonviolence, the question I always get is, what have you been able to do for us the past 2 years? And unfortunately, my answer is always not much.
And so on the moral question of when violence is justified, the big debate in the United States right now is whether to arm the Syrian rebels because the Assad regime is killing many tens of thousands of people there. Do you condemn the rebels as a nonviolent activist for using violence in that country?
As a nonviolent activist, I think the way that we usually look towards the situation is you do not condemn the victim, but rather the act that caused the victim to react in the way that they're reacting. Because when victims react with violence, it's because of a situation that they're living in, and they find that this is the way that they need to deal with it. Albeit that we do not support the use of violence for any reason, or from any side. But I do understand why some people feel like they need to resort to violence to protect themselves. Now, on the question of arming or non-arming, I don't feel like I'm the right person to ask, because I'm not a political analyst and I don't know if that would be for the best of the Syrian people or not. That's something for the Syrians to decide. But for Bahrain specifically, I think what we need is international pressure and consequences and accountability for the Bahraini regime in regards to human rights violations. That's how we resolve the violence on the streets.
Well, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. If the Nobel Committee honors you this year in the way that Ren Weschler and others want, it would be the first time a family won the prize, the first time the Arab Spring was the context for a Nobel Peace Prize, and an award that recognized what seems to be the best of the movement for human freedom and nonviolence that the prize was designed to draw attention to, both of those things, activism for freedom and nonviolence. So if even this discussion about the prize helps bring attention to the cause, it's a good thing. Thank you very much for joining us
today. Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And again, listeners, if you want to see and hear Maryam Al-Khawaja in person, she will be in conversation with several people as part of the NYU Institute for the Humanities tomorrow evening at 6:30 at NYU's Vanderbilt Hall. That's 40 Washington Square South. That's free and open to the public, in an event delicately titled, What the Hell is Going On in Bahrain? Again, 6:30 tomorrow evening, NYU's Vanderbilt Hall, 40 Washington Square South. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Radio Diaries founder Joe Richmond and some great examples from the stories and people that he has found 16 years after their original stories. He revisits some of his first subjects. We'll play old and new clips. Stay with us.